Today begins my third year as the host of Garden Life, so Happy New Year to everyone. I'd like to take a minute to thank everyone who supported and encouraged me through these years. I took some time to listen to last year's show and was reminded of how much I love learning about gardens, but the best part is meeting the area's gardeners, especially my frequent guest who's been on, three, four times?
I think so.
Christina Bauer, owner of Untamed Alchemy, whose webpage states, "We've grown our modest farm along with our skills, experience, and wisdom so as to best support, nurture, celebrate, and engage our farm's medicine." She runs her farm with her husband, Zach. And Christina, thanks again for coming in today. And give us a quick bio of you and Zach and your farm and your business.
Well, I am an herbalist, aromatherapist, and a distiller. So I grow medicinal plants and botanicals that I leverage in regular medicines for the body and for wellness. So most of what I make is topically applied, things like creams and lotions and balms. But I think the magic is in the making. And so I've always been kind of obsessed with learning how to work with things and make something more of them, hence the name of my business, Untamed Alchemy. Being able to work with wild plants and turn them into something that offers even more than the plant itself is kind of my jam.
Well, that sounds like magic to me. And that's what we're together here today to talk about is the magic of herbs. So first, it's the magic of growing herbs. So let's talk a little bit about what's involved there. Explain your five-element farm name. Explain to me what that's about.
Well, it really comes from the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, being the basis of all life and everything organic in the world. And that fifth element being love and spirit and relationship and engagement. So when we first purchased our property almost 11 years ago, I was really focused on making it a living, dynamic environment. And so I wanted each of those elements to be kind of celebrated and featured. So the farm name organically was born.
Another part of magic.
Yeah.
The elements. So it also says on your webpage, biodynamic organic method. Explain to me what that means.
Yeah, so we are what I would call biodynamically inspired and organically inspired. Organic certification actually takes a great commitment on the part of the farmer. There's a lot of paperwork involved with tracking and tracing everything you do from seed to sale. For me, it's out of scope of the scale of my small business. And so I choose instead to basically follow organic principles in that I'm working to make sure that the environment that I'm growing in is thriving without the use of a lot of outside materials. So I'm leveraging my own compost. I'm working with the soil that I have to improve and mature it so that it can be its own kind of thriving, rich material for growing. And most of what I do, particularly with respect to biodynamics, is paying attention to things like lunar phases and planetary cycles so that I can take advantage of some of the benefits of planting at the right time, harvesting at the right time, processing according to what I think will be best for the seeds, the roots, the flowers, the leaves that I'm working with.
And you found that that's effective.
Absolutely. I started there completely by accident. It was something that someone had recommended when I first was playing with a garden in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I readily experienced, like, my very first season, there was no doubt that it made a difference for me. So I've stuck with it ever since.
I plant by the moon signs as well. So I think it really works. Yeah. I'll do side by side and see it. Real difference.
Yeah. For me, one of the most important and valuable pieces of that was learning to rotate what I was planting so that every new thing that came into one of my garden beds was taking something that was readily available based on what had grown there before and was sort of readying the soil for what was going to come in next.
Okay.
So that was hugely helpful.
Let's talk about growing herbs, the rules for growing herbs. I was reading about, excuse me.
Yeah.
It having no soggy soils for herbs. They don't like soggy soils.
Typically, they don't. Now, there's a couple of them that like to have what we call wet feet. So things like mints, nettles, some of them prefer to be where they can readily access water. And so they'll do better if they have a little bit of moisture. But the key is really understanding what the plant that you're growing wants, knowing what its natural environment looks like and what it's asking for. Because some soils are going to want more acid, some are going to want more alkaline. Depending on the pH, some will require more nitrogen to thrive. Knowing what it is that you're growing and what it's asking for with respect to things like the appropriate amount of sun. How tall is it going to be? Is it going to be shaded by something else that is in its way? Would it like a shade partner to be able to grow better? For me, the key is really getting into relationship with the plants that are going in the ground so that I can be sure that I'm offering them the kind of environment that they need to thrive.
And propagation is very easy for herbs as well.
Yeah, for the most part, most of them can be begun simply from seed. So if you're someone who's already kind of anxiously rubbing your hands together and looking at what seeds to buy and what you can start, there's quite a few things, particularly with our short season, that you can get started on really early if you have the benefit of the appropriate environment for them. And if you've got grow lights, that kind of thing, then I know a lot of people who are starting now to get some of the things like the nightshades begun, you know, peppers, that kind of thing. Things that require a little extra time that our season doesn't always allow for if you're just planting in the ground.
Right. Another propagation method that I've been using is layering, you know, putting that long sweeping branch in the ground and letting it root, and a new plant begins.
Yeah. And honestly, one of my favorite things to work with are the perennials, those that come back every year of their own accord. Anything that can thrive in our environment is hugely beneficial to me, because for me, spring becomes that moment where those friends that I had last season begin to kind of peek their heads out, and they don't require much from me. So the mints that come back, you know, the lemon balm that comes back, I have calendula that self-seeds. All of those are kind of either volunteers or gifts that keep on giving, because I don't have to worry about them over the winter. As long as I've managed my garden well, then everything comes back often, I won't say with a vengeance, because it's a much brighter energy than that, but they definitely come back vigorously. And that to me is my favorite, because I don't have to do much other than walk out and be in awe.
And do you plant them in your main garden as a companion plant, or do you have specific herb gardens?
So I have, where I have my perennials, they obviously aren't moving. So things like my roses, I have echinacea that comes back each year. A number of those, they're not going anywhere. So around them, some of those beds they're pretty thoroughly planted with things that volunteer to come back each year. What I try to do is those places where I'm growing things like vegetables that are, or other annuals, those are the beds that get rotated according to, is this a seed, a fruit, a root, or a flower? And those are the places where I'm thinking a lot more about what can I sort of sneak in here. And I'm looking typically for how can I bring something into the garden that's going to add new benefit to whatever its neighbor is, whether it's offering some shade, whether it's pulling the right nutrients to the top of the soil. There's lots of different ways in which companion plants can kind of make a difference. Many of them will even improve the taste of something else. So like basil is a fantastic herb to have, not only because it's delicious, but also because it offers benefits to nightshades that it's planted close to. It tends to make them taste better.
Mm-hmm. Tomatoes, eggplant.
Yeah, exactly.
Peppers.
Yes, exactly.
I like basil throughout the garden. It's such a fun, easy plant to grow. And an annual, so it's not really an issue where you plant it. You can plant it within everything.
Yeah, you can move it each year.
Companion planting is really important as well, because it also controls insects and diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are things you can put into the garden like nasturtium. They have beautiful flowers, gorgeous round leaves. Those flowers happen to be edible. So if you want to put something beautiful in your salad, they offer that. But they will tend to attract, some of them will attract the pests otherwise that you have in the garden. They'll pull them over and basically draw them away from the plants that you want to protect. Some of them will repel them altogether. So anything that would otherwise come doesn't want to be close to where that plant is. So you can prevent, if you surround something with them, you can make sure that those pests don't actually make it to the plant at the center. There's lots of ways in which you can companion plant to be able to kind of get benefit from what you're putting in.
I had a tobacco plant last year, and I couldn't believe the white flies stuck on the back of those huge tobacco leaves. That was so interesting to me that they were taking care of the white fly problem in my garden.
Yeah, I have, with the moment I put roses in my garden, I had never had aphids before. And my first season, I thought, oh, this is going to be a nightmare. And I was able to, with many of the companion plants that I had, I attracted enough ladybugs that it looked like I had overspent and shipped them in from far, far away. They were all volunteers that came just because of what was in the garden. And they immediately took care of the problem. I mean, I didn't have to have any hands-on in terms of doing anything additional because the insects were doing it for me.
Do you remember what you used to attract the ladybugs? What plants?
You know, I have, because there's so, the garden is relatively small and I have so many things, I couldn't put my finger on the one thing, but I know that marigolds have helped a great deal. The sort of true marigold. Mm-hmm. I have pot marigold or calendula growing all over the place. I have quite a bit of borage. I love borage for its ability to attract the pollinators and a lot of the insects that, so there are a number of parasitic insects that eat other pests, and the borage is probably the most lively thing in my garden at any point, and I can use it. I can actually turn it into the soil as well. So I like to credit some of those. I like to think they have some hand in it, but for all I know, because I'm not spraying and because I'm not doing anything that would otherwise discourage the beneficial insects, I like to think that they choose the garden because it's not only beautiful, but it's the kind of environment that they want to be in. And so they camp out and I get all the benefits.
That is the benefit for no spray for sure. You get the good bugs as well as the bad. I had Ryan Eschker on a permaculture show last year and he was so funny about comfrey.
Yeah.
He was talking about his little farm, 4-acre farm, and the comfrey all over the farm and how that was so great for his fruit trees, his all of his composting. And even soaking comfrey leaves for a fertilizer.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about comfrey is it grows really quickly. It has lots of medicinal uses. So it's a favorite for many herbalists. But it also has these amazingly huge leaves. So it is something that you can quickly grow. It also has real benefit as you can use it as a mulch. You can turn it into the soil to become more organic matter to create your own compost. But it's one of my favorites. Nettles are another that work really well. And then weirdly, I learned last year that tansy apparently makes for great compost, which is great news for those of us that have invasive tansy all over the place.
Yes.
Like me.
Which is an herb. Tansy is an herb.
It is, although the one that we have growing up here for the most part is not. There's a blue tansy that has extraordinary medicinal qualities, particularly in its essential oil. The tansy that we have growing up here is really high in some of the ketones that aren't ideal for us to work with medicinally. So, and it also has some properties with respect to how it can create reactivity with the sun. So, most of us are just looking at tansy a little sideways and trying to figure out how to make it useful. But the fact that it can be a part of compost is like, hooray. It's got something to do in terms of the garden that isn't contrary to what I'm trying to accomplish.
It's same with comfrey. I've had a comfrey plant in my main flower garden that I have been digging out for 25 years.
Yeah.
And it's still there. And I just let it go and cut the leaves off, put it in my compost. Or it's a great bee draw as well.
Yes.
A lot of bees on the comfrey.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that attracts the pollinators is almost always a friend of mine.
I agree. I agree. In my past, I worked at Peaceable Kingdom, which was Lois Weiss' garden, and she had theme herb gardens that were so interesting. Shakespeare and Bible and moonlight and a thyme garden that was a fantastic bee pollinator garden as well.
Yeah.
And that was really fun too. Different than the companion planting, but still highlighting really the magic of herb in one place.
Yeah, it's absolutely so. I know people who have specifically medicinal gardens where absolutely everything that they grow is designed and intended for some kind of medicinal use. I know people who have done poetry gardens where, you know, individual plants that have been mentioned in poems throughout history are kind of celebrated. Meditation gardens where there's an emphasis on the equivalent of like stopping to smell the roses, you know, being able to kind of take a minute and catch your breath and get in the present moment. There are probably countless ways to organize and be inspired with respect to how you set up the garden that you want to surround yourself with.
My first herb book has a lot of themed herb gardens in it that are just so interesting. To Shakespeare was one especially that kind of caught my attention.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move into the magic of herbs in your home. Beginning with culinary, for baking, for cooking. I know a lot of cookbooks have guides to what herb goes with what meat or dish or whatever.
Right.
So you can use that to spice your dishes. And then also spice mixes. Do you make any spice mixes?
I do. In fact, I rely so heavily on them that it's the single first place that something goes if it's not being used medicinally. So I make blends according to often the kind of cuisine that I'm preparing. So for Italian, there's an emphasis on basil, oregano, garlic. For French, I'm looking at like chives, tarragon, parsley, chervil, marjoram. You start getting into Mexican, you're looking at like chili peppers and cumin, those kinds of things. There's endless ways to kind of figure out what belongs to this culture that was typically used in those kinds of foods that become staples in our house. My husband, I can't take credit for the taco seasoning that we enjoy because that's all him. He's a master pepper grower and he loves hot stuff. And his taco seasoning is the best I've ever had, far and away.
Great.
Yeah.
And vinegars, do you do vinegars or oils?
You know, there's not much that I don't do.
Okay.
Because there are so many things available and they're delicious. So infused oils for salad dressings. I'm a huge fan of fire cider. So an apple cider vinegar that has been that's been infused with onion, garlic, ginger, hot peppers, the kinds of things that kind of help to keep me safe. So we make a huge batch of fire cider several times a year that then becomes the base for most of our salad dressings. The infused vinegars are a great way to be able to kind of impart a flavor, even if you don't have the fresh herb to hand. So especially now in the winter season where I don't have my garden to be able to walk outside and grab the fresh herb, there's a lot that I'm relying on that was the magic of last season that's been infused into something that's kind of offering its medicine now or its flavor now in winter.
Great.
Yeah.
Do you freeze any spice?
You know, I don't freeze a lot. I will say I have made the little cubes of like oil with basil and other blends for certain things, particularly because something like basil, it's great to be able to make a pesto where it feels as fresh as possible as opposed to the dried. But for the most part, I like my herbs as fresh as they can be from the garden. So I'm not doing, I make a fairly modest amount so that I don't want to find myself in May with too much left over. I mean, to me, that means I've made too much.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost the medicine if it gets too far away from the date that I harvested or made it.
Right. A year is usually the max
for
herbs.
Typically, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's move to scents in the home. Scents, potpourris, wreaths, decoration, and into cleaning uses. Do you use any product for cleaning?
So I like to make, I tend to eat a lot of the little like mandarins and tangerines in the winter. And when I can get them organically grown so that I know they haven't been sprayed with anything that I don't want to impart into my blends, I'll keep the peel and add that with some pine needles into vinegar and let that soak. And that can become a base for like a surface spray or cleaning the windows in particular. Vinegar makes a fantastic streak-free window cleaning. We have a wood stove, so rather than using a diffuser or an air purifier or a humidifier, we have a pot that sits on the stove, and I'm regularly putting things in there like it's a simmer pot so that some of its aromatic molecules can be released slowly,
mm-hmm.
and we can kind of enjoy the fresh scent of whether it's pine or maybe cinnamon or clove. A lot of the hot herbs, so things like clove, cinnamon, ginger, marjoram, many of them have really strong antibacterial and antimicrobial properties, which I love in the winter when most of us are kind of trying to stave off illness. So mm-hmm. I like to be able to keep those things. And then something like a wreath on the door or hung someplace where it may be slowly warmed. So having one of those close to a fireplace, obviously not close enough to catch fire,
mm-hmm.
but being able to have those fresh materials in the house or the aromatic materials kind of slowly immersing. I mean, I always remind people that at at Christmas, for the most part, when people are making pomanders, you know, they're beautiful and they smell incredible, but they also have real purpose in that the citrus and the clove is actually really great for the immune system. So they're beautiful and aromatic, but they also offer real benefits beyond just the fact that, you know, they're seasonal and pretty.
Multifaceted. Yeah. Every herb has its many, many features.
Yes.
Then pest control. I was reading that sometimes they use it for pest control.
Yeah.
Well, what is the geranium?
Yeah.
Yes.
Geranium. So the geranium family, there's lots of different scented geraniums that have different benefits. Most of the plants that carry things like citronellol and citronellal, so lemongrass, melissa, have lots of great properties. I think probably one of my favorites is peppermint, because peppermint is really effective at deterring rodents and ants. But some of our favorite herbs actually have multiple uses in that regard. So lavender, basil, and peppermint particularly can be really, really great at kind of getting rid of things. And then, of course, when we start to get into the summer and we're looking at mosquitoes, the mints and some of the other citronella-rich plants can be really, really helpful in serving as natural deterrents.
Right. In the olden times, I think they would put peppermint in the house for scent as well, to keep it fresh.
Yeah, which is, of course, a great option. One of the things that we did for the short time that we had some mice that thought it would be great to move into our pantry, I simply took an essential oil of peppermint and had a tiny Q-tip, and I basically painted the equivalent of the threshold of the doors and the edges of some of the shelves to deter them. And for a brief period of time, my pantry smelled fresh and invigorating, and we were able to kind of discourage them from deciding that that was going to be their permanent home.
Oh, boy. I had a little mouse the other day. I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he thinks he's going to live with us. And no way.
He's mistaken.
How about herb dyes? How about the magic of that?
You know, that is something that I am prohibiting myself from getting too much into, because as a knitter and who is eager to begin spinning, I think that's probably my next rabbit hole. But there is no doubt that they're some of the most beautiful things. I mean, I for one am drawn to the beauty of botanical dyes. I think they're so rich and they're so earthy. So, you know, Pauline Ely at the market does botanical imprints and dyes with various plants, and then uses mordants to kind of set. And some of those colors are as beautiful as can be. And the fact that they don't have any chemicals that require, you know, and there's nothing in there that didn't come from nature. For me, that makes a huge difference. I mean, I think they're just gorgeous. But thankfully, that's not a rabbit hole I have spent any money on yet.
There's so much you can do with herbs that it is a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Her products are so beautiful. And silk, too. So the herbs are gentle for that fabric.
Yeah. And I think some of the art, you know, she has like a ginkgo scarf that's just absolutely breathtaking. I mean, her work is beautiful. It's beautiful and very much inspired by what she's working with.
Mm-hmm. Next, let's move to number three, for the family. Now, this is traditionally herbs were used to treat and maintain good health until we learned to synthesize drugs.
Yeah.
Then we lost that knowledge, whereas Chinese knowledge has gone on through the years, ancient knowledge of the herbs. So beginning with physical, internal tonics, like you were saying, the fire water.
Yeah, so fire cider.
Fire cider.
You know, of course, this time of year, I always think about elderberry syrup.
Yes.
You know, and some of the beautiful syrups that can be made. I love to work with the rose hips that grow in my garden. So I have a number of apothecary roses that, rather than leveraging them for their petals in hydrosol, I'm working with the actual bud, that rose hip at the end of the season. They're really rich in vitamin C, so making some infusions that can leverage that in the wintertime as a natural source for vitamin C is a huge favorite. And then there are, I mean, kind of endless ways that you can, even though they're not actively growing in the garden, you can be enjoying them in the off season. I mean, it goes between the dried herbs you can use to flavor and spice your foods, to the infusions that you can leverage, to having things prepared in the freezer. So, like, you know, freezing some of those cubes of the fresh herbs, all of those things make herbs and their magic available kind of year round.
I was going to mention Suzanne Taubert with the Cedar Mountain Herb School, and she has that calming calming book.
Yeah, Quest for Calm, I think it is.
Quest for Calm, yeah. Right. And that's all about calming herb tonics.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that there are so many things that grow all around us that offer medicine. Our responsibility is really to kind of discover them at the level of growing into relationship with them. So getting to understand what it is that they offer, how can we best engage that, and also how can we kind of protect and preserve it? So it isn't about consumption, it's about relationship and marrying your intention to thoughtful engagement with the plant. And there are so many ways to approach it. You can come at it from the place of I'm seeking a psychic or emotional benefit where I'm looking to feel differently than I feel right now, whether that's in aromatherapy where you're simply smelling an oil or an oil blend purely aromatically, if it's blended with other things that can go on the skin. So one of my favorite things about what I get to do with my work is I get to marry every single thing that I know. So I'm trained as a formulator, so I understand about how to make stable, natural products that benefit the body. But I also can bring in what I know about aromatherapy and what I know about herbs and their medicine. So when I make one of my creams that was originally crafted for new moms, I know that it's safe for babies. I know that it's calming and soothing. I know that it's gentle, especially for like sensitive skin. But there's also for my night cream happens to have essential oils in it that facilitate restful sleep. And so it isn't just great for the skin. There's other benefits as well. And there are, I think, probably infinite ways to approach of like, well, what is it I'm trying to accomplish? What do I have to hand that I can engage that becomes a part of making this blend, this formula, this recipe as potent and as on point as it can be based on what I'm hoping its outcomes will be?
Do you make oils as well as lotions?
So in terms of essential oils, you mean?
Yes.
So when I distill, I do distill. And for some of the materials that I distill, I am lucky enough that I am distilling at a scale where I do get oil. So for example, when I'm working with lavender, I use a lot of lavender. Mm-hmm. And because I'm growing and distilling it in higher volumes, I'm typically distilling enough where I do get essential oil to be able to take away. Some plants would require a scale that is impossible
yes.
for me. So, for example, lemon balm has an incredibly low yield for essential oil. So even when I'm working on my really big copper still, in spite of the fact that I put a lot of plant matter in, most of what I'm getting out of there is hydrosol. There's not a material amount of essential oil for that one. So it kind of depends on the plant. But for everything that I distill that has a higher yield, I typically am getting, you know, some essential oil away from it. So rosemary, rose geranium, lavender, I'm lucky enough to get some. Rose, a lot less mm-hmm. because there's quite a bit of rose that's required to be able to pull that over. Most people who are working with rose as an oil, I mean, I hope if they're working with a real true oil, most of what they're working with is really not the distilled rose. That's really expensive. It's gorgeous, but it's really expensive. Most people are working with a rose absolute, which is actually, it's been solvent extracted. So you're getting a certain amount more of the scent. For me, much of the medicine of rose is actually in the true essential oil, but the yield for that is probably beyond. I mean, I could never distill enough rose to have enough rose essential oil for all the ways that I'm using it.
Interesting. Yeah, every plant's different in that.
Yes.
In that factor. I was looking, you know, of course, massages, herbals for massages. You go into a massage studio and it just smells so beautiful with the oils. Baths.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's so many benefits to the whole body of... You get the aromatherapy benefit of your smelling what you're soaking in when you're soaking in the tub. You have the benefit of any medicinal properties that are sort of transferred over. So an Epsom salt bath with a certain amount of eucalyptus is a great way to kind of help open the chest and clear the breath. There are herbs that help us to kind of move mucus if we've got a thick, phlegmy chest.
Mm-hmm.
So there's... Again, kind of countless ways to be able to engage. You know, on the body, in oils, in creams, soaking in the bath, whether that's a bath salt or a bath gel or a bath foam, or even just a bag of the dried herb that goes in like a bath tea, where you tie everything up into a tiny muslin bag and toss that into the hot bath and then give yourself the opportunity to soak. It's wonderful. A lavender chamomile bath before bed is heaven.
It is. I do the chamomile tea bags and throw them right in the tub.
Yeah, exactly. It's the easiest way to do it. And it's wonderful because, you know, it's one of the shortest distances between the plant and the plant's benefit. So there isn't a lot of processing involved. So just being able to work with the dried herbs themselves is already a huge gift.
And then it goes in your skin, your biggest organ.
Yeah, it goes through your skin. And also you have, again, I can't stress enough that just smelling many of the aromatic herbs is already kind of a gateway to improvement and change. Mm-hmm. Because we have evolved next to plants. We are intimately related to their chemistry because we've evolved alongside them. So we are very vulnerable to what they offer. We automatically listen whether we want to or not. So even the plants that we don't necessarily engage every day, so like ylang ylang, which is a gorgeous tropical flower, clearly does not grow in North Idaho. But most of us will respond to the smell of ylang ylang at the right amount because it can be overwhelming and headache inducing if you get too much. But even a small amount in almost every human, the chemicals in there, the constituents in there that create a response in the body, we have evolved to respond. And so even though we're not from the tropics, our engagement with that is sort of automatically going to introduce an outcome of it tends to reduce the beats per minute that we have in our heart. It's been thought to reduce blood pressure just from smelling it. So there's lots of ways in which every plant that surrounds us is somehow in relationship with us, even if we've chosen to be, you know, silent to it or not listen to it.
Right. Even though we aren't aware that it's there. And it's a good thing you're here to turn it on for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if one person goes out into the forest and takes a terpene bath, as I like to call it, you know, forest bathing is one of the greatest ways, particularly on a day where the sun is shining and everything is kind of really glowing and there's a little bit of warmth. The terpenes and like the monoterpenes, sesquiterpenes that are released from the pine trees that surround us all over North Idaho are so incredibly good for us. So if one more person goes outside and takes a deep breath and takes that moment to check in with not only themselves, but what's happening around them, they tend to have medicine available to them that they probably didn't even know they needed.
That's right. This sounds like a good time to take a break. We've got a song queued up here, Christina.
Yeah.
Christina Bowers here with me, Julie Prochinski at Garden Life here on KRFY. And we're going to take a quick song break. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Wildflower. So come on back. We'll be back in a few minutes and we'll continue with our conversation. That was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and you're back with us on KRFY 88.5. I'm here with Christina Bauer, and we're talking about the magic of herbs, and it's been a great conversation so far, and hey, we got more.
We do. We do. I could talk all day.
So herbs, all parts of the herbs. Let's talk about harvesting, the magic of harvesting. All parts of the herbs, the leaf, the stem, the seeds, the roots, are used.
Correct? Yeah. So depending on the plant and what you're hoping to accomplish with it. So there are some plants that have much of their medicine in their leaves. There are others that concentrate in the roots. There are others for which it's all about the flower. Things like resins can also kind of come into scope. So really the key is knowing the plant that you're working with, what its medicine is and where its medicine is available. And to some extent, where the medicine is available in the plant will kind of guide you towards what's the best time to harvest and to engage it. So some of the root medicines prefer to be harvested after the flowers have bloomed and fallen, after they've kind of gone fallow. There are others where you want the bloom at the height of, you know, when it's at its earliest opening. It really depends on what the plant is that you're working with and which part you want to work with. And the key is always, to me, it's always about starting with kind of a listening relationship of what do I know about this plant? equally important, what don't I know about this plant? Like, where do I have to close the gap between what I know and what this plant wants and needs in order to be its best medicine? But just understanding it wants this much sun, it wants to be, if it's an annual, when it wants to be planted, what it might want to be planted near, what kind of sun it needs, and then making sure that you have offered it everything that helps it to make its best medicine.
You keep coming back to that simples idea, you know, simples being understanding everything about one plant.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, the key is the more I know, the less I know, because I'm always uncovering how much more there is to discover. And I've learned that I've never want to be identified as an expert with respect to any of the things that I work with, precisely because I'm so aware of the gaps that I still have, especially with individual plants. So many of the things that I grow in my garden, I'm in an ongoing relationship of learning. I'm a forever student in terms of discovering what it is that they have to offer and how I can best work with it. And every year, there's some new piece of information that translates into something that I can carry forward into the next year. But the plants that I'm not working with, those that don't grow in my environment or that I haven't put into the garden, they're all opportunity, because everything I know about them is really kind of surface, to be honest. And mm-hmm. So I always encourage people, it's not about knowing everything. You know, there are certainly advantages to, if you're planning on becoming an herbalist, particularly if you're moving into any kind of clinical practice, whether it's just for your own family or you're hoping to work with individuals for the betterment of their health. It's really, really important that you have a broad understanding of many things. But as a grower, I find that there are probably 15 of the materials in my garden that I have an emphasis on, not only in my products, but also in my wisdom, because I'm in dynamic relationship with them. And it's the dynamic relationship that has told me as much as I needed to know. If I've had to discover this plant seems to be struggling, what do I need to offer it to be able to make it happier? Or learning new ways to use other parts of the plant. So like when you talk about, you know, flowers, leaves, comfrey, typically I'm working with comfrey root medicinally, but the leaves are amazing as mulch. They're huge. They're amazing for mulch. And mm-hmm. So I begin to kind of expand the ways in which I'm engaging different things. So my mint that it features heavily in a number of products that I make, that same mint serves as a really incredible compost for the roses. They happen to love what the mint offers. So I'm often making like mulch and compost just out of mint for the roses. And that's something new to, you know, the last 2 years that I've learned. So I think it's about, in some ways, always learning. That's part of the magic of it.
Right.
There's always new things to discover.
That's right. And I bet your journals are vast.
They are. They're a little impossible to navigate. I wish I held more in my head of what was in my books, but I have a map over my garden, and I will say that I'm fortunate that anything that really works, it's easy to kind of go, oh, okay, that worked. I'm going to remember that for next time, because mm-hmm. Every year I hope I'm coming back with, you know, the best of what I discovered the year before and everything I've known in the years building up.
Now's the time to really be looking at those old journals and re-remembering what it is you learned last year and years previous as well.
Yeah, and also sourcing for gaps of like, what is it that my garden seems to want or that my life seems to want that I don't have sourced yet? So mm-hmm. Is there something I can potentially add that's going to add dimension to that garden and to my medicine?
Oh, wow. That is so great. So your business is Untamed Alchemy.
Untamed Alchemy, yes.
Untamed Alchemy.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And your webpage is the address for your webpage?
Yeah. It's www.untamedalchemy.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
And anything planned for upcoming events or?
Yeah, we have. So I do what are known as alchemical distillation journeys, where I invite folks to join me to distill a variety of materials that are compelling and relevant for the season that we're in. So the next one coming up will be on February 2nd in conjunction with Imbolc or Groundhog's Day. There's another that will be happening around the spring equinox. And then I have a green cleaning class that will also go up between now and April so that folks can have a chance to get a better understanding of how they can work with natural cleaning products that are sourced from herbs and oils that are readily to hand.
Just in time for spring cleaning.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the idea.
That's fantastic. Yeah. We have covered so much information today, and I just wanted to remind everybody that we will have a podcast going up later today that will have Christina and previous Christina's show today, and also all the other shows that Garden Life and any of the morning shows have been on. Yeah. So check that out, our podcast on KRFY.org. To conclude, herbs are magic,
yeah,
as Christina has proved to us today. And I learned, like I said, from Lois White at, yeah, Peaceable Kingdom, because the magic of herbs is also the sharing of herbs. That's something that we've all done throughout our lives without even knowing that it was magic we were passing on to,
yeah,
each other.
Yeah.
So Christina and I have established that this is a huge topic, like all gardening topics, and it's a lifetime study.
Yeah.
Like a forever, what, yeah, did you call
a
that?
A forever student.
Forever student. Mm-hmm. I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
So do you have to... finish, Christina, do you have a favorite gardening book or herbal book?
I would say that for anyone who wants to begin to work with herbs for medicine, Wild Remedies by Rosalie de la Ferre and Emily Hahn is absolutely incredible, as is same Rosalie de la Ferre has a wonderful book called Alchemy of Herbs that provides a lot of insight not only into the individual herbs, but also some of the ways that they can be leveraged. And they're great resources for anyone. I mean, I'm a seasoned herbalist and I still find so much inspiration in both of those books.
Alchemy is a perfect word for herbs.
Yeah, yeah, truly.
Because things are come from that weren't there before.
Exactly. You're making something more of the base ingredients that it basically reveals a transformation on the other end. Yeah.
That's so great.
Yeah.
So this is Christina Bauer with Untamed Alchemy, and I'm Julie Prochinski with Garden Life. We're going to conclude our talk today and go to a song. It's Lou Reed, This Magic Moment, but we'll see what happens when I push the button. Come on back. This is KRFY 88.5, and I'll have some news for later in the week on the garden, on the morning show, and everything else that's happening in town. Please stay with us.